The Rebel Capitalist Show, episode 261.
Welcome to the podcast that helps you build wealth and thrive in a world of out-of-control central banks and big governments. This is the Rebel Capitalist Show.
Hi, guys. Welcome to this evening's live stream. Sorry I'm late. I was just on another live stream with my good friends Ken McElroy and Jason Hartman. And we were talking real estate and inflation, deflation over there. And so probably, I apologize, but probably going to cut this a little short just because I haven't been feeling well all week. Let's get into your questions. Let's see what we've got here. Okay, is silver considered dry powder? And do you think adding to your position? No, I don't. And the main reason, I would say the same thing for gold, Roger, because what do you want to buy with your dry powder, or what is the asset you want to buy with your dry powder in the future? What is it denominated in? And my guess is it's not denominated in silver. It's denominated in dollars. So you do have a risk. You know, we can sit here and say, well, you know, silver is going to appreciate in value over the long run against dollars. And I would say that you're probably right. The probabilities are with you. But what is it going to do next week? What is it going to do in the next month? Can we say with a 100% certainty that the price of silver denominated in dollars is going to be higher next month than it is today in 30 days? No. Nobody can say that. So that's why I think dry powder, you got to keep it in T-bills. When I mean T-bills, I mean 4 week. I mean 3 month. I'm not saying, you know, 10-year treasury where if interest rates move, you're going to have a lot of downside risk, or you might have to hold on to that. No, with a 4 week T-bill, you just let it mature. You just get. And so why a T-bill? Because I'd rather have the Fed, or I'd rather have the Treasury as a counterparty than the risk if you've got over 250 in a bank account. If you have under 250, yeah, I really wouldn't worry about it too much. And I totally get it. You're going to be losing purchasing power. Yes, you will. Yes, you will. But I think that's just the carrying cost of having that, the optionality to go in and buy assets. If we have a crash, that's one of the nice things about the stock market is when we do have a crash, it can crash in 20% in one day, or it can crash heavy big time in like 3 or 4 weeks. It could go down by 40 or 50% in 3 or 4 weeks, where the housing market really can't do that. The housing market moves way too slow from a standpoint of getting a good deal like that. So if you've got that dry powder denominated in dollars, and also too, Roger, one thing I'd point out, this is with silver and gold especially, is usually when you have a big crash in the stock market, gold crashes as well. And that's because people need liquidity. They need to sell anything they can. And therefore, a lot of times, the only bid is for gold. And but you're gonna have a hell of a lot more sellers than you have buyers. So people, just these big hedge funds and institutions, sell anything on their balance sheet that they can, and usually that's gold. So you've got to think about that. Why have dry powder? Well, you have dry powder, so if the market crashes, you can take advantage of it. But you would be keeping your dry powder in an asset that would most likely crash with the stock market, you see. Now, I'm not saying it would crash long term, because usually it comes back up. But when you go back to March and look at what happened to gold, March of 2020, right? It all goes down when the stock market goes down, because people are selling anything they possibly can. So no, I don't consider gold or silver dry powder. I consider gold a insurance policy, and I consider silver maybe a little bit of a insurance policy, maybe a little more of a speculative asset, But no, I'm not saying I'm not bullish or I don't like it. I just don't see it as dry powder. What do you think the end game will start with, a political dislocation rather than economic fallout? I think they may be one and the same, Jim. Because let's think this through. Back in March of 2020, we went from having a Fed put to a government put, in my opinion. So we go from the Fed coming in and talking up the market, saying, oh, it's going to be okay. We're going to lower interest rates. We're going to do more quantitative easing. We're going to do these things. And so don't worry, the market goes down. We're going to step in. We're going to have the markets back. And the market would actually respond to that. Now, the only thing the Fed can really do, or up into that point, you know, is just do an asset swap with the commercial banks. So all they can do is just buy treasuries and or mortgage-backed securities and give the banks bank reserves. So that in and of itself doesn't do anything. It literally does nothing. Now, it's what the banks do with the additional balance sheet capacity that, you know, do they take more risk? And I don't know that they take more risk because of the balance sheet capacity is larger for loans, but I think they take more risk because they just believe in the Fed's expectation policy that the Fed is just going to make everything all right. So the risk reward makes sense to buy risk assets. But I think that changed in March when the Fed came out and announced QE infinity and all these things. And we saw that the market just shrugged it off and continued to go down. Well, that's not a Fed put anymore. And what made the market go up? What was the timing? How did that work? Well, you'll notice the market started to go back up on the Wednesday after the Fed announced QE infinity on a Sunday. And on the Wednesday, they announced the CARES Act. So I think the market looks at the government deficit spending and sees the stimulus and the CARES Act and says, okay, now this is what we can get behind. So then you have a bull market start from there. So I think we've gone from a Fed put to a government put, which goes back to your question. Right now, the amount of dollars, the only reason we're seeing is inflation is because, well, not the only reason, excluding the supply destruction. The main reason we're seeing inflation is because the government is deficit spending and the Fed is monetizing the debt, which gives a tailwind to the amount of dollars being created in the real economy, M2 or broad money. Now, I understand that those two metrics are not ideal. They're not that accurate. But if the Fed and the government would not have stepped in and done that, then we would have seen significant price deflation, especially in assets, maybe not so much in consumer goods, because again, you had a supply side of the equation there. But in with assets, we really would have seen some deflation because the banks were lending less. Therefore, there were fewer dollars that were being created. Okay, so the Fed had to fill the gap and the federal government had to fill the gap by deficit spending. So if the government doesn't deficit spend, then the amount of dollars that we would see in the system would decrease, most likely. It wouldn't increase. And therefore, if the amount of dollars in the system decreases, then we have asset price deflation. And if the whole entire economy is built around asset prices, if asset prices go down by 50% and don't come back up, that's the end game. That's the economic end game right there. Especially the U.S. is got real, real problems because we have such a financialized economy, and the economy is so dependent upon asset prices continually going higher and higher and higher. So you see what I'm saying is that now that control over asset prices going higher and higher is really on the shoulders of the politicians, and it's not so much in the shoulders of the Fed, in my opinion. Therefore, if we have political dislocation, there and then the central planners can't, you know, they're butting heads on everything. They can't come to terms on what type of stimulus package we're going to get or how much it's going to be. And if not enough stimulus or government spending is put into place, then that could lead to an economic fallout, because that leads to fewer dollars on net balance being created and a deflationary environment in asset prices, which brings down the entire economy. So hopefully that made sense, that bottom line is I think a political dislocation would lead to would create a chain reaction where it could lead to an economic fallout due to asset prices going down. People are still not wanting to take any of the jobs, and now they're quitting their current jobs for no reason. Will this force the government to pay UBI sooner? This is an interesting question, and I can't really get my head around it. You say, and I get it. We hear in the media all the time that people are not wanting to take the jobs available. There's all these jobs available, but just no one wants them. Okay, but at some point, that implies that people don't really need money, that they can just sit back and take any job they want. And if they don't want to work for a year and just wait for the right job, they can do that. And, you know, most Americans don't have $500 in a bank account or in a savings account to pay for like some sort of random car expense. So their life depends on their access to a credit card. So to say that most Americans just can sit back and have the option of working or not working whenever they choose, and for whatever position, that doesn't make a lot of sense to me. So if that is happening, then I think you've got to ask yourself the question, why? And I think the only reason can be because they've received additional government benefits, which allows them to be more picky and choosy. And that goes back to the question that Jim just asked. And, you know, when do we have that political dislocation, or do we have political congruency between the two parties where they continue with the UBI, which will allow people to be choosier and choosier about jobs, and therefore a job market that is wildly dysfunctional. And, you know, a lot of people that like, you know, more of the progressive narrative say, well, that's a good thing because people should have more job power. Labor should have more, more leverage. They should have more pricing power with wages. That's a good thing because wages have been stagnant for so long. Okay, yeah, but you got to look at a cost-benefit analysis. You're looking at the benefit. What are the costs? You see, the benefit is that labor has more leverage. The cost is, as a society, we're creating fewer goods and services. And if we're creating fewer goods and services as a society, that means by definition we are becoming poorer, regardless of how many currency units or dollars an individual worker is being paid, or regardless of how many additional currency units a worker is being paid. Because if all workers are being paid more, but yet we're creating less stuff, we have access to fewer goods and services, we're all poorer, even the worker that's making more money. So again, we have all these economic questions that I think have to start with political questions.
This podcast is brought to you by Rebel Capitalist Pro, the best online investing research. I have teamed up with Chris McIntosh and Lynn Alden, two of the best in the business, to create Rebel Capitalist Pro and give you the tools you need to build wealth and thrive in this crazy world of economic insanity. Rebel Capitalist Pro is jam-packed with Chris and Lynn's incredible research. We have live stream Q&As where you can ask your questions directly to Chris, Lynn, and myself. And the best of all, there's an online member forum which allows you to network, learn, and explore ideas with like-minded individuals. What are you waiting for? Check out Rebel Capitalist Pro right now at georgegammon.com/pro. That's georgegammon.com/pro. Take action today and do something your future self will thank you for.
Yeah, so this is a great point. What is this about Wells Fargo cutting credit lines? It goes back to that whiteboard video that I did where I was talking about reverse repo and counterparty risk. I mean, if you're Wells Fargo, you look around and you see an economy that's, you know, they've watched probably some of my videos maybe, and they say, wow, this George guy, I think he might be on to something. Do we really want to take on that additional risk? And obviously they stopped doing it because from a risk reward standpoint, it doesn't make sense. We know that, or else they'd still be doing it. So then the question becomes, what were the risks and what were the rewards? And I think that if you look at the risks with the mortgage forbearance potentially ending, the eviction moratoriums potentially ending, the incomes of Americans going down to a significant degree, just like they went up with all the stimmy checks going out, they could possibly go down to the same degree, if not more, in the future if the government doesn't continue with the UBI program, which they most likely will, but it's not a 100% guarantee. So they see a lot of risk in the system, I think. And then you have to say, okay, well, if credit or the issuance of credit or the issuance of loans is how dollars are created, that's how additional dollars are created. Well, what we see here is with Wells Fargo cutting credit lines, that means fewer dollars are going to be created in the future if you look at just that one isolated instance. Okay, if you just look at that in a vacuum in and of itself, then fewer dollars are going to be created because there's less loans, there's less lending. So this is deflationary from a standpoint of asset prices. Now that will require the government to do more deficit spending to fill that gap. And we've talked about the three phases or the three systems. I've talked about that extensively in videos. But another thing that you've got to think through is, what does Wells Fargo need to issue credit? Well, they need bank reserves. Now I'm not saying that those bank reserves are what they lend out, because they're not. That's kind of although the balance sheet works in a similar way, that's not the right way to think about it, in my opinion. You have to just see bank reserves that the commercial banks have as dollars on the Fed's balance sheet that are liabilities of the Fed. You have to look at those as just giving them the ability to lend. And the more bank reserves they have, the greater ability they have to create more dollar-denominated loans in the real economy. The more balance sheet, that's why I always say, it gives them additional balance sheet capacity to increase their lending. But they're not really lending the bank reserves. They're using those as a kind of a backstop. Because what happens is if they create a loan, let's say Wells Fargo, let's just use a line of credit. So you have a $100,000 line of credit with Wells Fargo, and you buy a car with that $100,000 line of credit. And the seller has an account with Bank of America. Okay. Well, that $100,000 goes into your account. So now those new dollars have been created out of thin air. And then you take those new dollars that are liabilities of Wells Fargo and you move them over to the seller's account at Bank of America. Okay, that's pretty straightforward. Most of us understand that. But what most of us don't understand is the fact that Wells Fargo isn't just sending them a liability and saying, oh, there you go, Bank of America, have fun with that extra $100,000 liability. No, they're sending them the bank reserves as the asset to match up with that liability. So on the Fed's balance sheet, what happens in that transaction is the $100,000 of bank reserves goes from Wells Fargo's account, bank reserve account, up into Bank of America's reserve account. So now we started with Wells Fargo having $100,000 in assets, $100,000 in liabilities, and that just got transferred up or over to Bank of America. That's how it works on the balance sheets. But now what happens is Wells Fargo has less lending capacity, right? Because if they create a loan that goes to another bank, then they have to transfer those bank reserves, right? Well, let's think through what happens with the reverse repo, right? With the reverse repo, those bank reserves are going from the reserve accounts of the commercial banks down into the reverse repo account to where they don't have access to those bank reserves anymore. They, meaning the commercial banking system. So by very definition, this decreases their balance sheet capacity to create more loans. So, and you say, George, well, why is that give me some context there. Okay, well, the amount of bank reserves in the system, around $4 trillion. So if the money market funds are doing $1 trillion a day, which they almost did a couple weeks ago in reverse repo, that's taking $1 trillion or 25% out of the system. So in one day, the lending capacity of the commercial banks goes down by 25%. That's a big deal. Now you may say, okay, George, but that's just one day, and you would be right. But we've seen it consistently above $750 billion for a long, long time. And as a percentage of the amount of outstanding bank reserves, or as a percentage of the amount of outstanding balance sheet capacity for these banks to create more loans, that is significant. That is very significant. So it could be a matter of Wells Fargo just not having the bank reserves and then saying, listen, if we're going to be constrained from a lending standpoint, we would rather allocate lending somewhere else other than these lines of credit, because from a risk reward standpoint, it just doesn't make sense. And the reason why I went through kind of that thought experiment is because I don't think most people would really connect the dots on they might connect the dots on the counterparty risk, but I don't think they would connect the dots on the counterparty risk, the lines of credit, and reverse repo. Because most people, 99.999% of people don't understand how the bank reserves and the balance sheets of the Fed and the commercial banking system actually work. What is your preferred format for physical gold? Bars? Yeah, bars. Yeah, I don't like the premium. Just bars. What would your YouTube channel be about if we had under control central bank? That's funny. Probably still macro, just because I really like thinking through that. But yeah, I'd love to have a YouTube channel about sports cars. Like, if you guys ever watch Doug DeMuro, he's one of my favorites. He does kind of reports on all these cars, not just new ones that come out, not just fancy ones, but old ones and kind of unique cars. And he's really great. And so, yeah, I would love to do a YouTube channel that just revolved around sports cars. That's definitely a passion of mine for sure. If equity bond markets are at risk of 50-80% drop, I don't know if the bond market is, but and the only safe place is in 401k. Let's see. And the only safe place in a 401k is in money market fund. That is even more risky. Would it be wise to force rollover into an IRA? I don't know anything about that, Justin. I don't know about a 401k or an IRA. I've never had one of those, so I'm not the right guy to ask the question. I mean, I've personally, and this is not investing advice. Personally, I'd rather just take the tax hit and have control over my own money. I mean, I get the tax advantage, but I right now I don't. For me, it wouldn't be worth it. Did I see Manorino's Camaro? It eats Lambos for lunch. No, I got the chance to meet Greg in Vegas. That was a lot of fun. And I didn't get a chance to see his car, though. I just got a new car that's pretty fast. And I don't know if Manorino's Camaro could hang with the car I bought. I just don't think he could get the track. He might have the horsepower, but I don't think he could get the traction to hang with me, like zero, especially 0 to 60, even in the quarter mile, maybe, but I don't know. I don't know if he could get the traction. That'd be a fun race, though. Would it be a good idea to put a lien on my precious metal to gain an asset? No, because your precious metal isn't paying you to own it. You would only want to have debt against an asset that was paying the debt. And by the way, gold, no, because gold is your insurance policy as well. So no, I don't like that. I only like taking out debt on things that pay, where other people pay the mortgage payment, or where other people pay it. Like if you borrow money to buy a dividend paying stock, let's say, and the dividend pays the mortgage, then, or the dividend pays the loan payment, then that's what you want. You want positive cash flow. I would never take out debt to buy a gold or Bitcoin or something that didn't pay me to own it. I don't think that's, you're just putting yourself in a position of potentially being a motivated seller, and you never want to be in that position. As rebel capitalists, you know, we want to be in the position to take advantage of motivated sellers by having leverage and getting a good deal and making a lot of money on the buy side. We never want to be the motivated seller. Yeah, the Camaro Z1. Yeah, this is Shannon's talking about a Camaro ZL1 aftermarket companies. Yeah, so Hennessy has something called a Exorcist. It's called the Exorcist. So look up Hennessy Exorcist Camaro, and that's what you're talking about. And yeah, those are badass. But again, you got to have slicks on it. I mean, if you got slicks on it, you could actually get some traction. That's great. But just because you have 1,000 horsepower doesn't mean that you can get any traction. And if you can't get any traction, the wheels just smoke. That four-wheel drive Lambo is going to beat you at 0 to 60. Although, once you get to, you know, 100 miles per hour where you can actually put your foot down, then it's going to advantage Exorcist, you know. Okay, guys, like I said at the beginning, I'm not feeling real great, so I'll probably just leave it there. We'll do some shout-outs for this week. We got Amaikoa. Yeah, Arthur is in the house. Good to see Arthur again. Alan Zibelman, the Rapfectionist. America's Soap, Biff Henderson, Gregory Wright, Glenn Godfrey, Russell Wallace Warren, Brendan O'Brien, Cash's Play, Dickie Dunn in the house, Brian Berdicia. Let's see, John Liano, Dakota Diesel, Carrie Agin, Justin Cabral, Nati Velasquez. Oh, where did that go? Nati Velasquez Lopera. Velasquez. Oh, there. Nati Velasquez Lopera. It's been so long since I've been in Colombia and spoken Spanish. My pronunciation isn't very good anymore. I got to get back in practice. Dave Laro, Fat Jack is back. Anita Walls. All right, guys. Enjoy the rest of your evening, and I will see you on the next video.
Thank you for listening to the Rebel Capitalist Show. For more content like this, check out the Rebel Capitalist blog at georgegammon.com or go to the George Gammon YouTube channel.